You are listening to the Dharma Ocean podcast. Mahamudra is a profound tradition of Tibetan Buddhist meditation that allows us to explore the vast space of our basic nature. Today's episode features the second half of Reggie's introductory talk to Mahamudra for the Modern World, a 37-hour intensive training course produced by Sounds True. Mahamudra for the Modern World is available for download at dharmaocean.org.
So I wanted to talk about the Mahamudra as a modern possibility within this framework of discussing Tibetan Buddhism a little bit. The Mahamudra is interesting because, as I mentioned at the beginning of this talk, it's the pinnacle of Tibetan Buddhism. It's considered the highest meditative tradition. It is the most direct and naked presentation of the Buddha's teachings. Most of Tibetan Buddhism is viewed as a series of steps to the Mahamudra practice. And some of these steps are necessary, and we will be talking about them in this program. But many of them really are more culturally based. For example, there is in the Tibetan tradition, among some of the schools, the idea that before you can really practice Mahamudra, you have to study for 20 or 25 years, and that you need to be a monk and you need to be male in order to do this, because in some schools, the only monastic people who are offered training in the scholarly study are men. So this rules out women, it rules out lay people. And that's not necessary, actually. It's more of a cultural thing. And other traditions say that the Mahamudra is not an appropriate practice until you've been meditating for, again, 20 or 30 years. And again, that's not necessary. That's a cultural thing. And it has to do with Tibet and the social setup, the fact that most people don't receive any education, and so they need to really learn to read and write before they can study the classics, and then they have to start meditating and so on. Most people in Tibet either raised animals or were farmers, and it was a very tiny minority that had direct access. Well, we're not in that situation. So we need to come back and take a look. And my question has been for the past 40 years, is Mahamudra this very simple, direct, naked presentation of the Dharma a possibility for modern people? And I think my answer and the answer of a lot of other people, both Tibetans and non-Tibetans, at this time in history is yes, it is. So many of you have had contact with Tibetan Buddhism, and I want to offer just a few points here. First of all, Tibetan Buddhism is a very, very complicated, complex tradition. And the Mahamudra is extraordinarily simple. In a way, it eliminates the need to go through all the stages and levels and all of the different preparations that are really extraneous to the Mahamudra as a tradition. They're just more Tibetan. The Mahamudra cuts to the chase, so to speak. A second very, very interesting point is that Tibet was, as I mentioned, very religious in the sense that it emphasized religious identities, community memberships, staunch loyalties to particular teachers and schools, a lot of competition between different teachings, rejection of other teachings and lineages and teachers as lesser. And in the modern world, this, doesn't really feel right to us. I mean, we are offered that possibility when we study with some of the more conservative teachers, but it just doesn't feel right. My teacher, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, said that this was not relevant anymore, and he was willing to talk about Mahamudra in terms of secular enlightenment, meaning that we can practice the tradition without being Buddhists, we can practice the tradition without being a membership of a particular religious institution or sect. In fact, we can practice this tradition without even considering ourselves religious people at all, because the Mahamudra is a way of working directly with the human mind and opening up its inherent possibilities of freedom and compassion and joyfulness. Third point is that the Tibetan tradition, if you've been exposed to it, is very ritualistic. There's a lot of ceremony. Patriarchy plays an important role. Hierarchy is very, very conservative. And the Mahamudra is a way of paring away all of those aspects as being unnecessary to the most direct and powerful path of transformation. In Tibetan Buddhism, you would go through a very great deal to get to the point of practicing Mahamudra, and then you would be asked to dismantle this religious identity that you had developed as a person in that culture. Well, we can go straight to that path. Most of us have pretty solid identities as whatever we are, secular people, religious people, as meditators, whatever. The Mahamudra applies directly to our situation, dismantling our conditioned identity so we can become a much bigger person. Fourth point is, I've already mentioned the restrictions applied to the Mahamudra teachings, and those are no longer necessary. One of the great teachers of Tibetan Buddhism, the 16th Karmapa, who was head of the Kagyu sect until his death, said that he felt the Mahamudra was the most appropriate teaching for the modern world. So I take a very great encouragement in his saying that this tradition really may be the key for us in terms of not only practicing meditation, but doing so within a secular environment as mostly secular people, and moreover, not sacrificing the depth of the Tibetan Dharma. And that's a point I really want to emphasize in this program. One of the unique things about Mahamudra is we do not have to sacrifice at all the depth of practice and realization and attainment as modern people. The Mahamudra offers us, so to speak, the full range of spiritual possibilities that really have ever existed in Buddhism, and the Mahamudra offers them in a way that we can practice and we can attain realization, we can attain the human fulfillment that is offered here. Many people of my generation who studied, particularly in the 70s when the Tibetan teachers first came, and also the 80s, took on the practice of Tibetan Buddhism, but we also took on a lot of cultural values, a lot of perspective, norms, ways of doing things, even ways of dressing and eating, if you can imagine that. And we thought that in order to practice the teaching such as the Mahamudra, that we kind of had to become Tibetans. What happened to many of us is, rather than achieving the kind of depth of spiritual maturity that this tradition offers us, the fullness of our human person, many of us became dependent on lamas, on teachings, on lineages, in a way that arrested our own growth. People developed a lifelong dependency on these wonderful people, but people from another culture, all of whom were men, and we stopped growing. We couldn't grow anymore, because rather than making the journey, the lonely journey, as we could call it, of meditation and spiritual realization, we surrounded ourselves and in a way padded ourselves with an identity that really wasn't ours. One of the other problems is that as modern people, there are certain developmental tasks that we all have and certain psychological challenges that we have. When you try to take on another culture and you try to take on, even though it's a very profound culture and very powerful culture and very compelling culture, what you do is you're avoiding the developmental and psychological necessities of your own development. So, interestingly, many people in the last 10 or 15 years that I've been working with, particularly my own generation, are coming around to realize that leaning on the traditional Tibetan situation and on the traditional Tibetan teachers, and trying to make the journey through them has not worked. And they're starting to see that the Tibetans have done everything they possibly can in giving us the teachings, but now we have to do the work where we take the teachings and we actually apply them to our life as Westerners. And we realize something that the Dalai Lama is often quoted to have said, which is the Dharma and the Tibetan Dharma, and in particular the Mahamudra, are never going to be established on Western soil until Western teachers are willing to make the journey on their own. Learn the teachings, but then make the journey and do the practices and have the commitments and go through all the ups and downs and all the lights and darks of the spiritual journey. And then, when that happens, and we discover that the Mahamudra is about this life and about this person and about the world that we live in right now and about achieving freedom within that, then the Dharma will be truly a plant that is growing in Western soil and flowering and producing fruit for Western people. So Mahamudra may be a very appropriate tradition for us as modern people, and in a kind of abstract way, maybe we can say that everything is here and we can make the full journey. But, you know, frankly speaking, how accessible is it really going to be to us as modern people living in this world with all of the stresses and strains and the tremendous input that we receive all day long and how busy we are? If we look at that, what can we say? When I was studying in Asia in my 20s and later, I was often told by Asian teachers, and really of all the Buddhist cultures, Tibetan, Nepali, people in Sikkim, people I met in India, Southeast Asia, Japan, I was told by everybody who, you know, were practitioners, Dharma practitioners, that one of the problems with the Western world is that it's so materialistic, and that some people, in my opinion, rather ungenerous way, often said that Westerners themselves are materialistic and they're not very spiritual and we can't really expect to accomplish much. Interesting, then, is Chogyam Trungpa's view, which is that there are more problems for spiritual practice in recent decades in Asia than there are in the West. In fact, when I met him in 1970, we voiced this view of, gee, you know, we're Westerners, what could we possibly accomplish because we're so materialistic? And he said quite the contrary, that the reason he was teaching in the United States was that he felt there was more openness among Western people than there was in Asia to genuine spirituality. And he wasn't talking about everybody, but he was saying there are a lot of people living in the modern world and living in the West who have a tremendous amount of curiosity, tremendous amount of openness, a real sense of the importance of meditation, which wasn't always true in Asia, strangely enough, and also who were willing to make the kinds of commitments you have to make in order to grow spiritually, to your spiritual practice and to working on yourself. So he said he felt that we in the West have, in many, many ways, more availability as people to the genuine depth of the Dharma. And the other thing he said, which I think is very important for us to realize, is Asian people in the traditional cultures generally had a very difficult, physically difficult life. In Tibet, most of the people in the culture were farmers, engaged in animal husbandry, they were nomads, they were traders, they were on the road most of the time, hiking between Russia and Tibet and India and Tibet and China and Tibet, and very little opportunity to practice. Even the people who lived in the monasteries, there were many, many people who became monks and lived in the monasteries, and a lesser number of nuns. These people were largely functioning as parish priests and as preservers of the academic traditions, people who did a lot of ritual. And in their case, they also had very little opportunity to actually meditate. The life in Tibet was generally very, very difficult, as it was throughout Asia, and there were no days off. It was a dawn to dusk kind of situation. And therefore, the only people that really were able to engage in meditation in a serious way was this tiny handful of yogis and yoginis, of men and women practitioners who went and lived in the caves and the wilds and the solitudes of Tibet. Also, in their case, in very difficult circumstances with never enough food, freezing cold all the time because of lack of fuel available in the mountains, cut off, unable to attend to medical needs, living with lice, rats eating their food, very, very difficult life. We, by contrast, living in the modern world, although from our point of view, we feel very beleaguered as modern people, and you know, often we feel we really don't have the opportunity to meditate that we would like to have. Nevertheless, most of us do not work 16 to 18-hour days. Most of us have an hour or two a day that if we were really honest with ourselves, we could devote to meditation practice. Most of us have at least one and sometimes 2 days off during the week where we can practice. And most of us have the ability to take off a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks a year to do solitary retreats. So Trungpa Rinpoche's point was that we really have, as modern people, we have a much greater opportunities to, on the one hand, to receive and understand and practice the teachings psychologically, but also in terms of the actual material life we live as Westerners. Huge opportunities. And then the third thing is that we have as modern people is that we have these extraordinarily profound teachings available to us. Just talking about Buddhism, we have the Vipassana teachings that were practiced by retreatants and hermits in Southeast Asia. We have the Chan teachings from China. We have Zen from Japan. And then we have the Tibetan meditation lineages from Tibet. And these are widely, widely, widely available in our culture. And if we're not attracted to Tibetan Buddhism, we can do Zen. And if we're not attracted to Zen, maybe the Vipassana movement. And then not to speak of all of the other very ancient spiritual traditions that are available in our culture. So this is the third reason why we are extraordinarily fortunate, not only as Western people, but now as modern people throughout the globe, that these teachings of meditation, contemplation, retreat practice, and so on are really available if we want them. So for these reasons, we are really living on the edge of a new day spiritually, I do believe. I think that right now, the work of the last 60 years, I mean, if you want to go back to 1950 when Zen began to become available, has really come to a kind of fruition. And it's taken all this time. It's taken a lot of work by people of my generation, of the next, you know, three or four generations, both meditators and scholars and travelers and all kinds of people to produce this situation. But now here we are. We have the openness as people, we have the time to do it, and we have the traditions we need. Finally, I want to say a few words about my own training in Tibetan Buddhism and in Mahamudra. As you'll see in this training program, I'm asking actually a lot of you. I'm asking you to bring yourselves fully to what you're going to hear and what you're going to see. I'm asking you to be willing to engage areas of your own life that you may not up till now have engaged. I'm asking you to allow the range of your own emotional experience, your own feeling life, to develop and open and deepen. And finally, I'm inviting you to take up this body of teachings that I'm offering to you, which are very extensive and in a certain way very thorough, and to make them part of your own journey as a human being in this life. So I'm asking a tremendous amount. And I feel it's probably really important for me to say something about where I'm coming from and the person who's delivering these teachings to you. I feel that most of us come into life, if not all of us, with a set of imperatives about how we have to live and who we need to be and what we need to do. Even though many of us don't find these out until even, you know, the moment of death could be the moment when we sort of realize who we have had to be in our life. In my own case, my history with Tibet and with Mahamudra begins probably self-conscious history when I was about two. And I had a series of experiences that were very disturbing, but I later realized that they had to do with the vastness of the human mind. In the meantime, I'm just trying to get my own little ego in shape. Throughout my childhood, also, there was a sense of the importance of this Tibetan culture. And when I was 16, I tried to go to Tibet. I started saving money and trying to go there, and I didn't make it because Tibet was closed at that time. I did get to Asia when I was 19, but Tibet was shut off. In 1970, I finally met Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, who was one of the greatest Mahamudra teachers, really, that Tibet has ever produced. And he had just arrived in this country. He was 30, and he wanted to teach the full depth of the Dharma to Western people. As I just mentioned a few minutes ago, he felt that the West, and particularly the United States, was a place where the Mahamudra teachings and the Tibetan teachings as a whole could be fully received. He had been really persecuted for this belief in England, where he had been previous to 1970 teaching. And he was persecuted because the people around him, the Tibetan teachers, felt that the Western people, as I said, were too materialistic and they couldn't receive the full teachings, and therefore they shouldn't be taught them. And he begged to differ. And because of it, he was kicked out of a monastery that he founded in England. And even the teachers around him, Tibetan teachers, informed the English security system that Rinpoche had gone insane and that he was no longer reliable and he shouldn't even be given a passport to leave the country. And there was an attempt to really discredit and destroy him in England at that time. He did manage to get to the United States, and I met him in 1970, shortly after he arrived. And from that moment, really felt that this was a person of tremendous realization and depth and very great humanity, and I wanted to work with him. So I started studying with him in 1970 and worked with him in many projects, including Naropa University in Boulder and other things, until his death in 1987. I was very fortunate because I was living the life of a teacher. I taught at Naropa University, and I also taught in a graduate appointment with the University of Colorado for 27 years. And during that time, really, I spent much of my time studying Chogyam Trungpa's teachings, the 17 years that he was alive, and then since then, really studying his transcripts, studying talks, you know, that I had heard, going back and looking at them, listening to talks that had never been transcribed. And even more importantly, particularly during these 17 years, assimilating the person he was. In the Mahamudra tradition, it's often said that most of the teaching doesn't really come through words. It comes through how a teacher does things, the qualities of his awareness, the quality of his mind, the way he interacts with other people, how he handles situations, the way he picks up a glass of water to drink it, the way he eats his food. When he's sick, how does he handle that? And really being around him and watching during these 17 years, I think in retrospect have turned out to be much more profound learning experience for me even than what he said or reviewing and studying later. In addition, I also have been able to receive a lot of Mahamudra teaching from the two greatest modern Tibetan Mahamudra teachers, Kenpo Sultrim Jamso Rinpoche and the Venerable Trungpa Rinpoche. So I've been a very, very fortunate person, particularly since 1970, in the last 40 years, in being able to really spend a lot of time studying this tradition and looking into it and seeing it from a lot of different angles and seeing it in particularly the person of Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. most important, of course, during this 40 years has been the actual practice itself. And as we always say within Buddhism, and particularly within Tibetan Buddhism, if you don't do the practice, it's like reading a menu and not eating the meal. Standing outside the restaurant and reading the menu is probably about 0.1% of the experience that's available. Until you go in and you actually eat the food that's offered, or in this case, do the practice, you're not really going to have much of an idea at all what it's about. So from the very beginning, Trungpa Rinpoche encouraged me in meditation practice. When I arrived at his door in 1970, I was in graduate school, and my idea of practice was half an hour, 45 minutes a day, and that's it. And he basically pushed me to do a lot more practice, and he basically said, you know, everything depends on your practice. If you're willing to practice a lot, then maybe something can happen. And if you don't practice, I'm pretty sure nothing's going to happen. So he got me to do a solitary retreat of a month in length. And after a week, I left because I thought I was going insane. That's not that unusual when you haven't ever meditated. You have a lot of ideas about what meditation should be. And when it doesn't live up to those ideas, you think there's something wrong with you. And since that time, it was a very powerful week, by the way, and I learned a real lesson about the importance of just sort of hanging out with whatever was going on with me and not making a lot of judgments about it. Since that time, over the past 40 years, I've probably done 5 years accumulated time in solitary retreat, 1 to 3 months every year, just practicing solitude, usually in the mountains. Again, very fortunate, a tremendous blessing because of my life as an academic person, having summers off, I've been able to do it. And then in addition to the 5 years in solitary retreat doing Mahamudra practice, another 5 years teaching in or leading, most of the time leading group retreats of other people. So again, practicing. So basically 10 years in retreat over the last 40, or 25% of my life has been in retreat exploring these practices. So it's been a good process, a good pickling process, and a good stewing process that I hope is going to benefit you in this program. So, meeting Rinpoche, studying with him for 17 years, studying the Mahamudra teachings, practicing the Mahamudra teachings in daily practice and in retreat. And then finally, I've been teaching Mahamudra for actually a long time, probably for 20 or 25 years, teaching individuals, being a meditation mentor for people, teaching Mahamudra programs and retreats with groups of people, exploring all kinds of different levels of teaching. So all of this experimentation and teaching and learning has helped me refine my understanding, not only of the Mahamudra tradition itself, but through working mostly with modern people, seeing how this tradition impacts our life as modern people and the spiritual possibilities that it really holds for us in the life that we live in this world at this time. So I want you to know that until now, 40 years after I met Chogyam Trungpa, I have not felt ready to do what I'm going to do with you here. I've been waiting for 40 years after meeting and beginning to study with Trungpa Rinpoche, feeling my way along, taking very seriously his commitment to the necessity of integrity in the teaching, that we mustn't water the teachings down, we mustn't compromise them in any way, that our obligation is to be absolutely faithful to them, and at the same time, absolutely faithful and loyal to the people we're teaching, meaning that your well-being and your development is critical. And part of my waiting has been because I felt I needed to study more and practice more, and also because the world situation up until now hasn't really seemed to demand that these teachings be given at this point. But now here we are 40 years later, everything, you know, I've been through my journey working with a lot of people, and I feel the moment has come for these teachings really to be offered in this way through recordings. And I'll tell you something, what I feel is that we're going to be able to go to a very, very deep level in this program, and that I'm going to be able to offer teachings that are as profound and as potentially transformative as any teaching that I've done. So here we go. All I ask from you is to take your own life seriously enough to listen to what's being said about you, because that's what these teachings are ultimately. They're about you and your goodness and the depth of your potential to become the person you need to be, the depth of your potential to grow to be such a large and open and present person to your life and to this world that you end up being an enormous benefit to all the people and all the beings and all the places that suffer so terribly at this moment. I want to conclude by offering a metaphor for this Mahamudra training. Let us suppose that we are an eagle in a cage perched on the edge of a cliff, that we have been dressed up in clothes, that we have a coat on, we have a hat, we have big mittens over our wings, and we have boots over our feet. And we have come to believe that this is who we are. We're weighed down with all these dark coverings, and we don't even know what our wings look like. We don't know what our claws look like. When we look in the mirror in our little cage, all we see is these haunted eyes and this rather disfigured creature all dressed up in a kind of comical way. We think that the cage is the normal situation, our normal situation, that it's our world, that's how things are. Meantime, we can see through the bars, and we look out and we see this vast open space ahead of us. It goes to infinity, and during the day we see the sun riding through the sky, we see the clouds, and at night we see the stars and the moon, and we feel such incredible longing in our heart. We almost want to throw ourselves into that space. We want to drink the sky, we want to touch the sun. We want to smell the moon and hold the stars. But of course we know that's not how things are. We're this weighed down, cloaked being in this cage. And even when we feel that longing, we think we're insane. We think we're crazy. And if there were other similar eagles dressed up, they'd be telling us, no, 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 you can't do that. That's not what it means. That's not what life is for. And then all of a sudden, somebody throws open the door. Somebody pulls the door of the cage open, and without even thinking, we throw off our boots, and we throw off our gloves, and we throw off our hat and our coat. And as we're doing it, there's some kind of huge surge, this kind of absolutely irresistible longing and urge to leap into the space, and we do. And we leap from the cage, and there's a little part of us that thinks we're insane and we're leaping to our death. But then our wings open, and they're huge. And we feel the updraft, and we spread our wings, and we ride up on the wind. And we ride up into that beautiful, huge sky. Up and up and out and out. And we look ahead and we see nothing but infinity. And we see the clouds and we fly up among the clouds. We feel their moisture, and then up higher and we feel the warmth of the sun. And there is such joy in our being. We feel so free, And suddenly our life feels so good. And we feel fondly for the first time. We actually know who we are. And we know why we were born. To fly like this through all eternity. To enjoy and taste and touch all the things that we meet on the way. And pretty soon, those dark clothes and that tiny cage just seem like a distant memory.
Download more of Reggie's teachings, find out about upcoming retreats, and to explore a variety of audio listening guides to assist you on your spiritual journey, please visit dharmaocean.org. Music is by Jeff Beal and Nawang Ketchog from the album Tibet, Cry of the Snow Lion.